Blog Talk Radio
presents a Blog Radio Show.
Everybody, welcome to Applause Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and I thank you so much for hanging out with me. Every time we have a show, it's a great time, and I love doing it, and I love hanging out with our guests. So before we get started, I would like to say thank you to Tabitha Starcher for joining us on Sunday. We had a really great conversation, and then all of a sudden there was a flash of lightning, and we got disconnected. So for those of you who want to know more about Tabitha, she is the business head of over at the Emmys, and she can be found at LinkedIn or on Facebook, or if you want to find out more information about her. And we talked about the business of show, basically the sponsorship, how sponsorships have changed with online, you name it. You could get sponsors anywhere now, and how the industry has just changed dramatically. So we had a great time and a great conversation, but my apologies for those of you who are listening, and of course to Tabitha for getting cut short, but it was a great show. And if you want to go back and listen, you can. So, but tonight we're going to have a great time. I'm a big Carpenters fan. I'm sure many of you are. I mean, how could you not love the music and her vocals? But tonight, I think we've got the biggest, I don't even want to call him a fan. He's a Carpenters music historian, music conductor, musician. I cannot speak. What is wrong with me? And a musician himself. He is the co-author of the Carpenters, the musical legacy that he wrote along with Mike Sidoni Lennox, who is a 40-year career in the entertainment industry as a journalist as well for Billboard and Variety. So, and also it features Richard Carpenter himself. So we're going to find out more about that. We're going to find out a lot more about Chris. So let's welcome to the show, everybody, Chris May. How are you, Chris? Thank you so much for hanging out with me tonight.
Hi, Joanne. It's a pleasure. I appreciate you having me on your show.
Oh, no, thank you. When I saw you, I was like, I got to talk to Chris. I have to talk to you. I have to. Because you know what? You look like a young guy to me. So for you to have such a fanaticism, I hate to say it, but you do, you love them, and I and their music had a really big effect on you, that you, I think, started playing the piano because of them and became a music genius yourself. Chris, I can't talk tonight, I'm exhausted.
Well, let me tell you, first off, looks can
bear
be deceiving,
with me.
But yeah, I was born with a love and a gift for music, really multifaceted. Yes, piano and keyboard instruments are my, you know, principal. I play one instrument, that is all keyboards, if that makes any sense. But I developed or learned that I really had an ear for arranging and music production and all of that when I was quite young. I want to say around 5 or 6 years old. And, you know, heard the Carpenters, of course, in the house. I was born in 76, so, you know, that I'll just give it all away right off the bat. I grew up listening to their Christmas albums, namely, but then in the late 80s, January of 89, the made-for-TV movie, The Karen Carpenter Story, came out on CBS.
I
and I was at an age where Yeah, and Richard was involved in that. We talk about that a bit in the book. He regrets now having been involved, and, you know, as we've tried to explain to him, and I think he's aware, is that it, you know, really raised up future generations of Carpenters fans. I get that the narrative in the story was not entirely correct and accurate. However, because Richard was involved, he was using all of the original multi-track tapes. He was essentially not only serving as an executive, but he was a music supervisor. So all of the streamers and all of the music and, of course, the original Carpenters tapes were used in the film. So
yeah.
I knew at that age, I want to say I was around 11 or 12 years old, that this is what I wanted to do, because Richard really, to me, at that age, represented, with the exception of songwriting, that's not something that I've ever had a passion for. But, you know, on the Carpenters records, I mean, Richard wasn't just, you know, a piano player. I mean, yes, he played the piano and all of the keyboard overdubs and whatnot, but he was a songwriter. He picked songs. If he didn't write them, he was the one responsible for picking them and making sure that they worked for Karen and for the Carpenters and the Carpenters sound. He was producing. He produced every single one of those records. You know, he was the arranger. You know, the arranger is the unsung hero of the business, as many producers will tell you, and Richard feels strongly about that. And he's right, you know. And so there was just something about – and, of course, Karen's voice. And
yeah.
Their sound, they together were greater than the sum of their parts. And I think I had the wisdom and you know, sort of that intuition as a young boy to recognize that in them. And I was bit by the Carpenters.
Yeah,
I don't know.
The music just pulled you in. It really did. And just to see the way he did the arrangements, I mean, and they did everything themselves, which was great, like all the vocals, the overdubbing, and he knew just when to, you know, double up on the vocals for the choruses and bridges and whatnot, and he was really talented. He really was. Oh, he still is. I shouldn't say was. My God. He's very talented. So if you wanted to emulate or want to be an arranger, what better person to get into than Richard Carpenter? I mean, really, just a classical genius, music genius for our times.
Well, and of course, Karen, you know, yeah, and Karen, you know, as far as I'm concerned, she's one of, if not the greatest female singers that ever lived. I mean,
I agree.
Hear them say it. There are a lot of talented vocalists out there, make no mistake. But Karen had something that, and I don't read into it like a lot of, you know, you have a lot of fans that say, oh, you know, that she, you know, that everything that she sang was autobiographical. I don't know that I believe that necessarily, having
a little bit more
insight into their background.
Yeah,
but
I don't either.
She was well beyond her years. I mean, you know, most people don't realize that. You know, if you look at their catalog, I mean, everything that certainly all of the big biggies, the big hits, and, you know, we're talking, I mean, you know, 12 top 10 singles, 20 top 40 on Billboard. I mean, she was 20. Let's see. She sang Close to You. She had just turned 20, sang a lead on, you know, just about everything on the Close to You album. I mean, she was no more than 25 years old, 26, by the time they really – they had released a few singles after, you know, that, you know, when she was a little older, but, you know, she only lived to be 32 years old.
That type
of voice doesn't come out of somebody that age. She was well beyond her years.
Yeah.
And same with the wisdom. It wasn't just her God-given talent vocally, but it was in her brain. And she knew how to deliver a song. She knew how to place. She knew mic placement. That was a lot of it. She was not a loud singer. I mean, she was very soft.
Right. Effortless and seamless, and didn't have to go be – she wasn't a screamer. She didn't have to be, and it just – everything was about – her voice is just perfect. I mean, the it's not too low, but yet it's just right there. Everything about it was – it's just perfect timing at the time, I guess.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And,
you know,
and then of course, Richard knew how to showcase that, you know,
right.
And, you know, he, to self-produce like that is, and he and I have had just, you know, several discussions about this. It's one thing I've mentioned to him on several occasions. I said, you know, it's very difficult when a producer, and I realized that there were two Carpenters, and essentially it was like he was really, he's producing them as the duo, but Karen as the lead. Very hard to get out of your own way and showcase the talent when and have the ability to step outside of yourself enough. You know, oftentimes producers that end up going solo with their own singer-songwriter type career will say, for instance, oftentimes we'll bring in an outside producer because it's almost impossible to produce yourself. But you know, Richard, he really knew how to, he knew how to pick the right keys. He knew how to pick the right songs. And of course the arranging and the production and everything. I mean, it just was, they were certainly born to do what they did together.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so weird. I don't know if I should bring this up or not, but I used to wonder if he ever like had a problem that, you know, he was the creator of what she was able to do. And like she was more popular. Nobody really, the average Joe didn't care about the arranging and stuff. You know, a musician does, but the average listener loves the voice, whether it's the voice, the music, or whatever. They don't think of the genius behind what got the song done, as in Richard, as we're talking, you know. So I always wondered if he had a problem that she was really considered the breakout of the group, the duo. And I don't know. That's something that I always thought about. I wondered if he always had a deep down, like, oh, man, I'm doing all the work and she's getting all the glory, you know. But they both did. They both got glory in my eyes.
Yeah, right. Well, I think that, and that's part of the reason if you really look into their career, and particularly the concertizing, you know, when they went out live and did, you know, one of the major changes that came in and around 76, you know, when they did quite an overhaul and revamp of their show, was to help balance that out a little bit. And, you know, Richard, I think, and he'll tell you, you know, hindsight being 2020, now you look back and of course all of that has come to the surface and people, I, to be honest with you, I think it was part of his reluctance or tied in when we did the book, in that, you know, well, okay, what kind of an interest is there still in this? And is this something that's going to, you know, I mean, how many people are we talking? I think he's been quite amazed at just not only the reach, but the age. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people, you know, I get emails, I get messages, I get mail, I get, you know, calls or whatever once in a while. And almost on a daily basis, I have somebody writing in or something, asking questions. I can't tell you how many of them are teen, you know, teenage years, you know, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, of course, all the way on up to 70, 80 years old and whatnot. But the point is that there's an interest in this group that isn't going away. If anything, it's just gotten bigger and bigger.
I know.
So to answer your question, yeah, I mean, you know, I think being human, any of us would probably struggle through some of that, but he also recognized in himself the fact that he was an arranger, a fabulous arranger. You know, he had the accomplishment of writing the arrangements, of writing, you know, a number of their songs, their hits. And, of course, there were a number of album cuts that are, you know, quite lovely, actually. And some of those even, you know, it's been argued that a few of those even could have been considered hit-worthy. But, you know, so, you know, at the time, I can't really speak for, you know, where his head was in the 70s.
None
of course,
of
they were both dealing with their own personal stuff, too, trying to get through all of that. And I think for them, they were chasing, you chase success. I mean, it's like, you know, you get a hit, you get a single, you got to follow it up with another, And you can get into, and I believe that they certainly got into this thing where rather than looking back at the accomplishments, I mean, even by 74, 75, I mean, my goodness, how many top 10 singles had they released? But they were so focused on, but you know, what about this one? What about this album? What about, you know, and I think that, you know, you can become so self-focused on what you don't have versus what you've already accomplished.
Exactly.
And I don't, you know, I think it was Yeah, I think, you know, Karen was never really able to break out of that, and it took Richard some time, I think, looking back to realize just how successful they were, and he's incredibly grateful for that.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, the good music will live forever. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, it just, if it's good, it'll live forever. Now, I have to ask you, who came up with the idea of writing the book, The Carpenters, A Musical Legacy? Was it you or Mike, or who reached out to who?
This book was, so this is something that actually that I had approached Richard on a couple of years, two, 3 years prior to meeting Mike. But
I'm sorry, Chris, did the book, you had already known Richard personally? I thought maybe you met him with the book.
Richard and I go back about 20 years, and I think he and Mike technically go back probably closer to 30 plus, although Richard and I have stayed in much closer contact.
Yeah.
Over the years, but as far as this book, the musical legacy, Mike was the one that approached me and said, kind of a long story short, I've been a longtime co-moderator, contributor for a website called A&M Corner. It's a popular discussion forum that's dedicated basically to artists who have been signed or were signed and distributed by and through A&M Records, which is now owned by Universal. They've absorbed and distribute the catalog. And back in 2017, and I've been involved there for close to 20 years now. Back in 2017, the Universal had put out a vinyl box collection on the Carpenters. It was all of the studio albums, sans the Christmas albums, but it was all the their studio albums reissued on 180 gram vinyl, because remember, you know, in 2017, the whole vinyl resurgence, I think that year it was like something like $1 billion industry, and it's still big business for the record industry. And so Universal took out a press release. Mike, my co-author, whom I had not met at that point personally, was still working as an entertainment journalist for the Associated Press. He did the interview with Richard, and he posted the link to the interview on the forum, in the Carpenters, in the sub-forum, the Carpenters forum. So I reached out to him, and I said, hey, great story. Anyway, long story short, he was aware of me and my background with the Carpenters. I wasn't at that time familiar with him. I very quickly became familiar with his work and all of his writing over the years. And so he said, I've wanted to meet you for a while, and I would love to exchange phone numbers. So within a week or so, I mean, we had talked several times, and he said, look, I don't know how you feel about this. You know, I've wanted to write a book that really focuses not so much on their personal lives, but really on the music. And, of course,
music.
That was exactly where I was trying to go with it, with Richard. But Richard didn't want to, you know, he tried all of this back in the early 90s, and he co-wrote an autobiography with the late Ray Coleman, which was supposed to essentially be what this book ultimately turned out to be, and instead ended up being what Richard calls or dubs the anorexia book. Essentially, it was really put more of the spotlight on Karen's illness and death and Richard's problem with prescription with Quaaludes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he really just kind of got burned on that. I mean, he doesn't blame that author, and looking back, because he feels that he was really just trying to do a service in getting to the bottom of what killed Karen. But, you know, Richard felt like, you know, you put so much time and effort into something and then have it turn out to be something other than what you signed up for.
Right.
So he was very reluctant to get involved with this book. And so, you know, when Mike asked me about it and he said, look, I think you're the guy that, you know, I can't do this alone, and I think we should do this together. And I agreed, but we made a deal right off the bat. Look, if we don't get Richard's blessing with this, we don't want to do it. We both felt confident that we could put out a good, solid book.
Right.
Even without Richard's patience, but I can't tell you how, just the hours and hours of, really it was 4 years total in the making, but it was, you know, two years spending, it's what seemed like every other day at Richard's, you know, if it wasn't interviewing for the book, and we were very meticulous. I mean, we went chronologically year by year, album by album, topic by topic, I have, you know, so much in my archives. I mean, it's in terms of those interviews. And then once they were convinced, because I was really the one that was pushing more of the ephemera and the rare photography, the photographs and the images and that kind of thing, I think once that image, or once that vision, rather, began to take shape, and we got Richard on board, finally, which was also Mike's doing, it came together rather quickly. It took a long time, but it was hurry up and wait. And then once we were there and once it got moving, and of course we had a publishing deal and we had a deadline, and we said, well, sink or swim, we're going to get this done, because
we have to do it. So who better to get involved? I mean, Mike, like I said, he's been in the entertainment industry for 40 plus years now, and you are a carpenter's historian. So, I mean, the two of you, and then to throw Richard in the mix, I mean, you can't go wrong. You're covering every aspect of the carpenters there, you know. So, so the book is The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy, and there's some great, I believe, never be for seeing photos in there, right, Chris?
Yeah. So, you know, there are, as I mentioned, not only photographs of Richard and Karen throughout the years, but a lot of ephemera. Richard has quite an archive, both stored, some of it stored at his house. He has a media underground, so he's got a ranch-style single level with a basement. But really, it's 2,500 square feet of, you know, it's all media. It's carpenters.
Wow.
I mean, it's one room is devoted to nothing but photos. You have another that is, of course, his own personal record collection, and then he's got a number of, you know, various, acetates and, whatnot from the carpenter years that he brought home from the studio and held on to all these years. And then, of course, he's got a complete library of all of the releases, you know, on just about every format from, vinyl to
reel to reel,
the singles on 45. I don't know if he held on to the reels. He might actually have a few of those, but most of that is definitely the 8-tracks and, of course, the CDs, all the cassettes. And then he has an entire warehouse where he keeps his automobile collection, and out there he has quite a bit that he's held on to. In fact, he tells the story, you know, his folks held on to a lot for him over the years, would put this away or put that away. And of course, things that he held on to were things that belonged to Karen. And about 20 years ago, he was going through everything. He says, why am I holding on to all this? And he decided that he went through and meticulously cataloged and sort of numbered and indexed everything that he had. Of course, he's held on to all of the original arrangements, all the charts, all the, you know, we're talking studio charts, you know, the strings and the horns and the rhythm and all the stuff that was, you know. And he said, you know, little did I realize that, you know, 20 years later this would come in handy. Because believe me, I was on him about a lot of this stuff. I said, look, you know, I think we should put this in. You know, how about this? I'd put together lists and. And I think he finally, once it all started to come together, he realized, and there was a day where he just said, well, here you go. If there's anything in here that you know, thank you. And so, and then, of course, he had the final sign off on everything once I went through and Mike and I went through and decided on what we were going to, what we were going to put in and what we were going to leave out. So it was a lot of work, but labor of love for sure.
Yeah. And I got to ask you this. I mean, how cool is it that, did you ever think that you would actually like be friends with Richard Carpenter? I mean, he's pretty much the reason why you love music so much and started playing piano. I mean, that's my opinion. I think that's what drove you.
Yeah, and I've had my own music career. I mean, the historian bit with the Carpenters really just sort of happened by accident. It wasn't. I didn't set out to do that. I've been an arranger, music director for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just learned. I can tell you that when I was quite young, as I said, I knew that there was something oddly unique about my infatuation with it, and it wasn't for me. It was just every time I would deconstruct and reconstruct a Carpenters album, it was like a college education. I just had this sort of sixth sense ability to hear it and listen to it. And he'll laugh at today. He'll say, you know, we'll be talking about something, and he'll say, you know, there's maybe one or two other people that can hear that. You will be talking about something very, very specific on an album in a place. And I don't know where that God given. That's the only thing I can attribute it to, is because it helped to shape my own career, which in turn helped me to understand how the Carpenters did what they did, because I've worked in the studio as a producer. I've worked as a music director, arranger. I say that simply to just draw the connection between what I understood because I lived it in my own career and what Richard did on those albums. It's part of the reason why I understand it so well, is because I also walked in those shoes in my own career, my own right, if that makes any sense. And so
right.
I really feel that there's some fate element to all this. I know it sounds kind of bizarre, but the years that, you know, he and I have stayed in touch, and then for it to develop into this, you know, I am so grateful for that man and his family. You know, his wife Mary as well. They both are dear friends of ours, mine and my wife Giselle, and who, by the way, was very involved in the book as well. She's a graphic writer, so she had quite a bit of involvement as well. But it was, we had a great time. It was a lot of work, but we had a great time.
Yeah, speaking of designing, did they hate doing those album covers or what?
Oh, well, you know, that really was a lot of what we needed to get into in this book. You know, the Carpenters really overcame, despite the setbacks and the obstacles that they faced at their label. You know, A&M was a great company to work for. Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, for those, you know, the A and the M. In fact, we just lost Jerry about 3 weeks ago.
I know. Passed away. I know.
But they were a great company to work for. But, you know, the problem that Karen and Richard ran into, and we talk about this, as I said, almost ad nauseum throughout the book, is that there were people in management that were not happy that Herb and Jerry signed him to the label, because they just were too young, you know, middle-class, middle-American kids, were supremely gifted and just wanted to make honest, sincere music. And the, you know, other staffers at the company, you know, this was a time of hard rock, acid rock. You had, you know, free sex and love and drugs and rock and roll. And, you know, it was like, and you signed the Carpenters. And so, you know, and that was the beauty of A&M. And, you know, especially with her being the musician side of all this, is that, you know, their first album they put out in 69, you know, they released their first single, Ticket to Ride, which peaked at number 54 on Billboard, so it didn't care. I mean, to land in the top in the Hot 100 was great, no matter which way you slice and dice. But you know, they were really going to have to. They were going to have to do better than that if they were going to really make a name for themselves. And everybody, you know, at the label essentially said, "Well, get rid of these guys." You know, we didn't. They weren't happy that they were on the list. So you had that. You had pushback from people in upper management. You know, that were. You know, eventually you had a manager who really was acting as an agent. You had an agent who was acting as a manager. You had, and of course, Karen and Richard were, they were raised to be polite and to be just respectful. And I think at that time, of course, they were so grateful for the opportunity. They had worked so hard to land their record deal that they just kind of went along with it. You know, their first album cover, which was the least attractive of all, Richard, of course, will be, and again, we get into this in the book. You know, Herb looked at a number of shots that their art director had laid out and said, that one. And of course, they were thinking, no way, but they weren't going to argue with Herb Alpert. They were glad to have a deal. Well, this went on. And then, of course, they had a manager who was just overbooking them because, of course, they, you know, these concerts they were making. In the early days, I mean, making money hand over fist. The problem was is that as you know, the further they got along, by the time they hit 1974, I think they had to perform 170 plus 174 shows a year just to break even because of all the overhead and staff and the personnel. And as Richard says, the success of an album, of a record, of a song is in the grooves. If they never concertized, if they never went out on the road or never did an interview, you know, if a jock decided or a PD decided that they were going to put a song on the radio, your audience is going to tell you, you know, Joanne, I mean, your audience is going to tell you whether or not you've got a hit on your hands.
Yeah.
And they, you know, case in point, Top of the World. I mean, that was, it was an album cut. Richard thought, nothing of it, and never thought of it as a single. And they get over to Japan in 72 and the crowd's going nuts and they're begging them to do the song. And so they go in and they rework it, put it out on, you know, as a sort of a reworked version of the album cut, and then put it on the singles 1969 to 73 the next year. And that thing shot to the top. You know, yeah, Richard, you know, to this day feels that they were not managed well. I mean, he had, you know, a number of instances where he felt strongly about a particular record, and you had executives at the label who
– that said no, right.
It was almost like they were pushing back just because they were trying to antagonize them. I mean, of course, you had journalists that were writing nasty, vicious things about them.
Right.
Who – really had nothing to do with any – it had absolutely nothing. That's why I say really what this book was meant to do was to celebrate the legacy of the Carpenters and that they overcame all that. Unfortunately, Karen succumbed to her eating disorder, which is a whole other deal. But, of course, you know, that's going to be, you know, exacerbated by the pressures of the business. Not that she didn't enjoy the business and working hard, but Karen, everything Karen did, she did 110%.
Well,
and then
absolutely, but like
to, you know,
like you said earlier, just 2 minutes ago, that you know the critics were so vicious that I think maybe that's what even pushed her over the edge, thinking that she wasn't attractive or anything. And she was. I mean, You know what I mean? She wasn't a raving beauty like Anne Margaret or Raquel Welch, but she had her own beauty. She was very attractive, and I, you know, the viciousness,
right,
like
absolutely.
You said, that was horrible. And I remember years ago that critics, I mean, they would write about people and who are you? You know what I mean? Who are you to ruin someone's career, life in one stroke of a pen? It's just, it was horrible back in the 70s and 80s, especially, oh my God. And I remember that. And you know what's funny, Chris? I review concerts sometimes. If it's bad, I don't write about it because I'd rather not.
Right.
I'd rather not say anything bad about somebody because who am I?
Yeah. Well, and you know, and then it was like it was a competition too. Who could outwrite the other writer?
Right.
You know, who could write an even nastier? I mean, some of the stuff was just really. You just know when you read, and you know, the problem is, and I've often said this, and this is just, it's neither here nor there now, but. You know, we all go through the early years in life where we're questioning, you know, things and we're, you know, coming into our identity and trying to, you know, as young adults. And, you know, they were so driven at such a young age and they were so focused and so much time and attention went to their craft as teenagers. I'm talking about pre-Carpenters when they had the Carpenter Trio, you know, and they had Rich Carpenter Trio and Spectrum, their vocal sextet, and they were writing, you know, Richard was writing songs, and they were recording for Joe Osborne at Magic Lamp, which is where the demo came from that ultimately made it to A&M. But they worked all the time, and that was an ethic that was really instilled in them by their parents. But they, you know, they found success so early. My feeling on it is that they found success so early, and of course, then once you get into that, like a hamster's wheel, you know, it's like you've got to keep that wheel moving. And by the time that all of these other issues really were coming to the surface, they didn't have time to deal with any of that, like the rest of us or most of us do at some point in our young lives. And so I think that they, you know, they missed out on that in their early lives. And that would have, you know, it meant tremendous success for the Carpenters and for the group. But, you know, it definitely took its toll on Richard, and it killed Karen. You know, and I know he wishes, you know, that she could be around to see all this. You know,
of course,
to be part of it, because there's just, you know, he said in an interview with CBS when they were promoting our book, and he said, you know, the interest in this duo of ours never seems to go away, or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, if Karen, essentially, you know, I wish you could see that. It's just that to think that there would be that much success, and you know as well as I do, hindsight, again, being 2020,
yeah,
you know, he has a much different perspective, I think, on things. I think there's certain things that he's able to let go of now that he couldn't then, and other things that he's looked back at and he's taken issue with because he's gone, my goodness, if we had just maybe spoken up sooner.
Mm.
And they did, finally, but by that point they were already in the, you know, they were sort of in the lion's den by then, and it was, you know, it's sort of sink or swim. You just got to get through it and hope you get to the other side.
Right,
you
right.
Know, and
well,
it, they paid a big price for this.
Yeah, and they'll always have the longevity in this in the music industry, no matter what kind of music is out there. Like right now, the music to me is not fantastic, but you know. It is what it is, you know, it's cyclical, you know, the music industry. So it changes,
right.
But it just hasn't, I always said it's cyclical, but it's never gone back to what we want. But anyway, but music will never die.
Yeah,
good music will never die. That's for sure. But
the thing is you can't manufacture music like that. You know, their records were, yes, they were ahead of their time in terms of the technology, but that was real music, real sound passing through the air into a microphone with no auto-tuning.
Yep.
No, you know, Karen.
No special effects.
Sang. I mean, that's another whole thing. Nah, I mean, you know, there were some studio effects that were used, but in the earlier days, it was, you know, reverb and chorus and
that's it.
You know, delay
right.
and echo
right.
and I mean, you had basically it's like your four basic food groups, you know, and then everything is just all just sort of a tweaking from there, and you know, things you could do as the multi-tracking capability became. I mean, that's the other thing is that they relied so much on that. And, of course, Richard was a huge, as was Karen, but especially Richard, was a huge fan of Les Paul and Mary Ford, you know, starting with How High the Moon in 1951. And, you know, all those vocals are Mary, overdubbed. Well, Les was the one that came up with the technology to do all of that.
Mm.
And, you know, little did they know, you know, 20 years later, they would be, as the Carpenters, utilizing that very technology. And as their talents, as they grew and expanded in pushing the limits of that technology, going back to, like I said, pre-Carpenter days, even when they were recording demos in their living room. I mean, they started on two tracks, and then they were up to four tracks at Osborne's, you know, for the Magic Lamp experiment, that, you know, in 1967, 68. And then by the time they get to A&M, now they're on 8-track recording, and a year later it's 16 for the next 4 years, and then 24. So it's really interesting how, had they been born at any different, you know, had they been born any earlier, really, it, you know, Karen's voice would have been Karen's voice again.
Right.
But, and Richard's talents, but they wouldn't have had the luxury of being able to do what they did, and they made some great records.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
absolutely. Yeah.
You know,
I mean, there's so many great songs. I mean,
technology.
Yeah, there's just so many great songs. And you as a, I'm going to call you a carpenterologist because I think that suits you. You're a carpenterologist as far as I'm concerned. You must own basically everything they've ever done too. I mean, you've got to be a major collector too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that started... What's funny is that the formal collection that I have now didn't start until later. I had so many copies of every format of everything because when I started out with this was an education for me. I was an arranger and a producer and a keyboard accomplished pianist and keyboardist. So I was learning I was learning every inversion that he was playing and the way he was playing behind Karen. And I used that later on. I was a music director for a large church for quite a number of years. And, and then had done a lot of studio projects in and around that and worked in secular music as well. And I cannot tell you the majority of, we'll say a large part of my musical education came indirectly and in some ways directly from Richard and from what I learned and the production value on those records, because neither of them were slouches in the studio. I mean, they worked their tails off, and they got everything as close to perfection as they could, you know, given the time constraints they had because they were on the road so much. So they didn't really get the time that they needed in the studio, believe it or not, as great as those records all have turned out, you know, to think that there was more time that could have been spent. And,
could you imagine?
Certainly that they could have made them even better, you know.
Right, could you imagine?
Sometimes. But,
wow. Mm-hmm. I know, yeah. I always wonder what would she be doing now, and how much further would they have put more music out? And whatever happened to the solo thing she did around the disco era? Did that, did you ever hear that?
Oh, sure. Well, that album, that Richard finally put that album out in 1996.
Oh, he did? Okay.
So,
I thought that he didn't really care for it, and that's why she didn't release it.
Well, there's a whole, you know, bunch of debate about all of that, and, you know, who shelved the album and why they shelved the album. You know, she went in and cut the album in 79. I think Richard was a week or two into rehab for his pill addiction, finally.
Mm.
And, you know, Richard has said many times, Karen was somebody who could not sit still. And she always had to be working, in other words.
Mm.
And so she, you know, whether she was soldiering forth on, whether it was personal appearances or things that needed to be done, you know, in terms of professional business related to the Carpenters or her own. And, you know, he doesn't fault her or, you know, blame her for wanting some sense of independence. And it wasn't
right.
That she was in any way trying to break up the Carpenters. But I think she was trying to, you know, she was trying to figure out. At that time, there was a lot of pressure to, you know, to do that, you know, to prove that you could be somebody on your own.
Right.
It was just that was sort of the thing. The problem was that she was very ill by this point. And, you know, I think had she gone into treatment when Richard went into treatment for his problem, you know, had she really taken some time off, he took a whole year off. She went and recorded the album.
Right.
And at the end of the day, you know, she did have the final say. A lot of people think that, you know, Richard or the folks, you know, put the stake through it. The label, look, record labels are in business to make money, period.
Right.
If
right.
A&M thought for 2 seconds that that album had a hit on it, wasn't that it wasn't well produced, wasn't that all of the songs were bad. There were a lot of songs.
Oh, they would have
really
released
were,
it in a harmony,
okay.
Of course. Yeah.
But if they had a single, you know, they put a chunk of change in. I mean, Karen ended up putting up the majority of the money because she was hell-bent on doing the album and wanted to go
mm-hmm.
do it. A&M,
mm-hmm.
you know, Herb and Jerry gave it their blessing. Richard gave it his blessing, I reluctantly, I think, because he didn't, you know, he told her, he said, don't go do disco, number one. And
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, anybody, I don't care who you are and what you say, but, you know, if your whole life, I don't care if you're making records or you're selling real estate, if you work that closely together, and in this case with a sibling, and the minute that you go to deal with your problem and, you know, your sister should be dealing with hers and isn't and wants to go off and make a solo record, I think at the time, yeah, there's going to be some hard feelings about that. And I am not speaking on Richard's behalf. I'm just
of
saying that.
Of course not. Right.
He would not be human had he not experienced any of that. But
right.
the issue was, at the end of the day, there just really wasn't a hit on the album. And
mm.
people, this has brought a lot of division, I think, amongst fans who want to say that, oh, you know, Richard was jealous, and so, you know, he begged her not to put the album out. Look, at A&M would have honored the fact that the Carpenters were still a unit. They, in fact, their contract was up for renewal again, I think in 1980. They would have had no problem promoting Karen as a solo and promoting the Carpenters. And they don't just shelve stuff because somebody, the brother comes along and says, hey, you know, don't put this out. Herb and Jerry knew that was, it wasn't, it likely was not going to get the reaction that Karen had hoped.
Yeah.
Does that
wasn't
mean
commercial.
That she shouldn't have been proud?
Yeah.
No, yeah. But that doesn't mean that she wouldn't, that it isn't just because it, you know, it was a huge accomplishment. I mean, the work that she did on that with producer, the late Phil Ramone,
mm-hmm.
the production was outstanding. I mean, the production value, the all of Karen's, you know, her, the songs were keyed too high. I agree. Richard has said that many times. And Karen's voice was down in the low red, you know, in the contralto. I mean, that was her thing. And a lot of the cuts on there were up high and really kind of almost in the stratosphere. And at the time, I think, and she, you know, she, one of her close pals was Olivia Newton-John. And I think there were a lot of things. I think she really looked up to Olivia, and she wanted, I think in some ways she wanted to emulate her. Not saying she did that throughout the whole album, but the album to me feels a bit contrived, if I'm being honest. I never got the feeling listening to that ever close to the feeling that I got when I listened to, I mean, never mind a Carpenter's album. Listen to, you know, when Michael Jackson went and did his, you know, went on embark on his solo career with Quincy Jones. Look at you could hate Michael and his music, but you can't deny that those were incredibly made records, incredible songwriting, incredible delivery. And had Karen's album lived up to that, we'd be saying the same about that, I think.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I have to ask you now, again, you probably own everything under the sun, and it's going to be a hard choice. But what is your favorite song? There's so many great ones.
Oh, favorite song? Oh gosh, I like them for so many. Well, the one that I've always sort of gone on record when I'm asked, as far as non-Carpenter written, so you know, in terms of songs that were covered but not written by Richard and John Bettis, We've Only Just Begun and Superstar are. The production and the hook and all of the
everything
about it.
Yeah.
To this day, I've never faltered on that in that answer. I mean, that's always been the answer I've given.
Yeah.
I think as far as the Richard composition, of course, Yesterday Once More. Top of the World, you know, for as
too.
Much as I think John Bettis, who wrote the lyrics on that, mentioned to me in a conversation one day that it's almost kind of like a, I think it was John that said this. I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure it was John. You know, that it's kind of like a lullaby. You know, it's a very simple song, simple chord progression. And again, one that Richard never thought twice about putting out as a single. But, that song has certainly made him a lot of money over the years. Let's put it that way. Major hit all over the world. Still to this day is cherished by so many Carpenters fans. And
I
Top of the World is one.
Yeah, I would love to hear Superstar right now. You want to hear that with me?
Oh, absolutely.
Let's play it. This is Superstar, guys. I don't even have to say who it's from, who it's by. Enjoy for the next 3 minutes.
Long ago,
Yeah, can't get any better than that. Oh, man.
You know, she said this story has been told a lot. She sang that in the first take.
Wow. Wow. I believe it. I believe it. I believe it. Because her voice was just so effortless. And, you know, she didn't have to, you could tell she just wasn't even trying. And it was perfect. You know what I mean? It's just great. That's unique talent.
Yeah.
That's born talent.
Well, they always sang, anytime if she wasn't on the drums in the studio, which contrary to popular belief, there were quite a few studio cuts. I mean, she did play on a number of studio cuts, but the majority of the hits were all Hal Blaine, Jim Gordon, other seasoned studio drummers. She always would sing a Workley. They would cut when they would start the foundation for a master on a song. The bass, the drums, piano, and Karen would sing a lead. And back then, before you had a dedicated isolation booth in a studio like you have now, they would use the airlock, which is the passageway between the outer part of the studio and the inner room. And so the studio guy, Richard and Hal and Joe, like in the case of Superstar, were out in the studio set up and play. And she was in the airlock singing the lead so that they could hear the track. They just had a rhythm chart in front of them. There were no lyrics or anything on it. And this was just to familiarize them with the song. That's how we have so many posthumous recordings of Karen that were just really Workley. They were outtakes, and the reason for that is because she went and she sang a lot of this stuff while the initial tracking was going on.
Always,
if they, she would always go back and recut the lead if the song was deemed, worthy at that point to go on the album, if they felt like they had room for it on the album. With Superstar, that was their third album, the Tan album in 71. It was such a rush job to get that thing out. The whole album is a total of, I think, 29 minutes or 30 minutes. And like Richard says, we didn't have a lot of time with production. Her vocal wasn't getting much better. I mean, she sang the work lead, and then she went in to actually start recording what you would call the master lead. She started working it down. It wasn't getting any better than what she had done, and we really didn't have the time, so we went with the work lead, and that's the vocal that everybody hears.
How much better than that can you get? I mean, that's just pure, vocal talent there. I mean, like I said, it's just so natural. It just comes out of her so naturally. So, listen,
she
is
a phenomenon.
Yeah. Is Richard still writing or no? He's just pretty much retired now. What's he doing these days?
Yeah. Yeah, he's writing. Yeah, he's worked, and he's recently worked on a project with his kids, and he has other stuff that he does that he keeps busy with. He's not really writing for other artists. He's done a number of projects over the years, several that have been released commercially, and then several that would start and it wasn't quite what he was picturing, and so stuff would sit on the shelf, and he'd go back, and then he'd try to rework it. So he's definitely a perfectionist and excellence driven, certainly, and maybe a better way of putting that.
Right.
And he's always writing. There are a lot of he'll say, you have somebody write, that would have been perfect for Karen, or he'll hear something. In 2018, if you're not aware of this, the Royal Philharmonic, the Carpenters with the Royal Philharmonic album was released, and so he went back in with the Royal Phil. With the original
with
Carpenters
her vocals
and
right
and read it yeah and with her vocals and their backing vocals, and some of the original rhythm tracking was all in there, but a lot of that even has been recut, and so he worked on that. He got and got to add some things in that he wished he had initially, or fatten the strings, larger section, that kind of thing, and then right after we put out the book in November of 21, I want to say January of 22, he released Richard Carpenter's Piano Songbook, which is essentially solo piano. It's for Decca, on the Decca label. And that was all reimagining, if you will, Carpenter songs just for solo piano. And so that was released on both vinyl and CD, and that's done very well.
Cool.
He does what he wants to do.
Yeah.
He has the luxury of just picking and choosing, and he seems very happy doing that.
He's Richard Carpenter. He can do anything he wants.
That's right.
Right.
Well,
let me ask you, Let me ask you, as a musician, have you released any of your own original music as well? You have
no,
a CD
I'm not
or
a writer.
Anything else?
I've done, most of my work has been commercial, either on stage. Done some studio production, but I haven't really done any dedicated studio producing in a number of years. I enjoy that. But I found as I've gotten older that I have talents in multiple areas besides music. Uh-huh. The foundation is music, and I've been very fortunate to be multifaceted there, but also involved in everything from video and photography. And there, I just have this creative brain. And as technology has grown, I've gotten involved. I'm involved in social media. I oversee the Carpenters
website,
a lot of their social media and Richard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but it keeps me busy and I'm happy. So.
Well, I got to ask you, since you're friends with Richard, did you ever get your hands on the 30th anniversary collector's item that they put out from Japan?
Oh my gosh, are you kidding? Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because it was that was the set that prompted me to finally go full bore with the collection that I have, even though I already had a bunch. And real quick story, I finally got my hands on a 30th set about 10 or 12 years ago.
Oh, good.
And then the 35th set came out, a duplicate of the first set, but with the 35th set included the two Christmas albums, which the 30th did not.
Yeah.
And I inadvertently offed the 30th set that I had and always regretted it. And Richard gifted me, when we finished the book, he gifted me an artist copy, a sealed artist copy from his collection of the 30th anniversary set.
Wow.
And Mike wanted the 35th. And so he gave Mike the 35th set and he gave me the original 30th to replace the one I had. And of course, this has a low production. They all had serial numbers on them, you know.
Yeah.
It was a limited run.
Yeah.
So I have all those box sets, the 30th set that was replaced of mine is actually one that came directly from Richard's collection.
Very
cool. And, of course,
cool.
All of my – I keep everything sealed.
So, nice.
Oh, absolutely.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. I just can't fathom the thought of being enamored with his talent and sort of the drive behind your talent and, you know, like, that's what I want to do, that's what I want to be, and then you actually meet him and you actually write a book about him. I mean, well, that's just amazing, right? I mean, my God, did you ever imagine this would happen to you?
Yeah, tell you what, I'm a faithful believer in Christ. I have had some things that I could write a book about the things that the Lord has done in my life, let me tell you. And so it doesn't surprise me, but it just at the same time just amazes me. So yes, I'm right there with you. I'm just grateful.
Wonderful.
For every minute of it. And I've been very blessed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, folks, go out and get the book. It's The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy, and you got to check it out. I mean, I got to check it out too. I haven't read it myself, but I can imagine. I mean, it's big too, right? It's like 400 pages, I think.
It's 384 pages, I think, something
and,
like that.
And just
yeah,
amazing pictures in there too that have never been seen before. So how cool is that? Oh my God! And I guess you can get it everywhere online and in Barnes and Noble and all that. And you must have a website, your own, or just the Carpenters website you're working with.
Oh well, as far as the social media, yeah. Well, Carpenters. So we launched a. With Richard, but I oversee this. The Carpenters Official on Instagram, and then Universal runs and oversees their Facebook site. Although every now and again, I'll give them things to post on there if it coincides with something that I'm talking with Richard about or something that we're trying to coordinate with on Instagram. And then Richard has his personal Instagram that I also am involved with, which is Richard Carpenter Official. So. And then I'm on A&M Corner. It's amcorner.com, which is the Carpenters Forum. There's deep, deep discussion. The forum goes back about 25 years. If you want to learn anything and everything about the Carpenters, that's a good place to start. So
that's
I'm
the place
involved
to
there
go.
As a co-moderator and a contributor as well. So.
Excellent. Oh, my God. Well, Chris, I had a great time hearing your stories. My goodness, the book is probably jam-packed with stories as well as not only just focusing on the music, too. I mean, there's got to be stories behind the music and stuff like that, that, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so I got to get me a copy.
A lot of behind the scenes, yeah.
Yeah, I have to get me a copy.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. If you're a fan, it is a heavy book. I mean, it wasn't intended to be a coffee table book, but it borders, it's pushing the limits, but it certainly is a heck of a read. And if you want to see a lot of the imagery, supportive imagery, this book's definitely got it. So.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, my goodness, oh my. But I was going to play We've Only Just Begun, too, when we close out. My favorite part is when Richard does the, and yet we've just begun. I love that note that he does in there. Oh, my God, I just love it. And it's overdubbed a little bit, and it just sounds so great. Every time he does that, I don't think anybody really...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really considered him a singer because Cameron was the singer, but he's a singer too.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they were meant to sing. They're like peanut butter and jelly. I mean, it'll be to sound cheesy, but he was no slouch in the studio, and their vocals together, those four part, five, six part harmonies, you know, close harmony. I mean, you know, how many artists have emulated him or tried to copy them over the years?
Right.
Yeah, they're unmatchable in their talents.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Well, Chris, again, thank you so very much for hanging out with me tonight. It's a pleasure. And guys, go check out the book, The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy, and you'll love it. I know I would love it when I ever get a chance to read it. It's audio, too, right? There's an audio, but you don't get that picture factor.
No audio book, but you can do digital, but it just doesn't – the digital download doesn't do it justice. You really want to hold it. And trust me, if you go – happen to be by, Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or whatever, you know, go in. A lot of the stores have them on the shelves, and just go pick it up. I think you'll enjoy it.
Wonderful. Absolutely. Well, everybody, Chris May, go check out the book, The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy. You won't regret it. And it sounds like a great book. And if you're a Carpenters fan, you'll love it even more. If you're just a music fan, you'll appreciate it. That's what I'm gathering from it. So, I mean, I'm a music fan and a Carpenters fan. So that's my peak to want to see it, to want to read it and see it. So I'm looking forward to getting it. I really am. I'm definitely going to go pick it up.
All right.
All right. Well,
I appreciate
you
having me on the show, Joanne.
Oh, no. Thank you so much, Chris. Please come back anytime if you'd like. I'd love to hang out and talk with you again. I can't even see.
You bet.
This is crazy. Right. Everybody, thank you again.
Oh, I've had those late.
Yeah, you know what the thing is? Oh, my God. It's just been crazy during the day. I've had a lot going on, and today I was just exhausted. I'm wiped out, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, I'm tongue-tied. I can't even talk. I'm punch drunk, you know? So, but, oh, God. Chris, thank you again, everybody. Chris May, go check out the book, The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy, co-authored with Mike Sidoni Lennox and with Richard Carpenter himself. So you can only imagine what's in there. So thank you again, Chris. You take care. And hey, we're friends now on Facebook. So, you know,
it's official.
It's official.
If it didn't happen on Facebook, it didn't happen.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. Chris, thanks so much. Have a great night. You take care.
You bet.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. Everybody, Chris May. Take care, Chris. Bye-bye. Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. I wish I was more lively tonight. I am beat. And we've got another show tomorrow. Oh, my goodness. We've got Georgiana Noopy Rodriguez. Do you know who she is? She's a television producer, and she's also the daughter of the legendary comedian, actress, singer Rosemarie. And August 15th, they celebrated Rosemarie's 100th birthday, and they called it the celebration, the centennial celebration, and it aired on YouTube, and you could still see it, and I think they did something called the 100 Days of Rosemarie, too, where every day they did something or said something that I don't know, we'll find out tomorrow from Noopy or Georgiana. I don't know her that well, Cora Noopy. But so she'll be on with us tomorrow. And they also released a album, the complete, oh, God, what was it? Oh, man, I have it in front of me somewhere. Rosemarie sings the complete Mercury recordings, and it's the first time ever released. So for those of you who don't know, Rosemarie started as a singer, so, and became in when I was growing up, more well known for being on Dick Van Dyke and the Dick Van Dyke Show and the Dinah Shore Show, and of course Hollywood Squares. But I mean, I was a kid then, but I didn't know that she was a singer at the time. So, but yeah, that's how she started. And she started very young, actually, 90 years in the, I think it was 90 years in the entertainment industry. But can't wait to talk to Georgiana tomorrow. Georgiana Nupi Rodriguez will be joining us on Thursday the 21st at 9 p.m. Eastern. And then we've got another legend in the music industry, Mr. Jay Asher, will be joining us on the 24th. And we're going to have a great time with him, too, and talk about his music career and the songs he's written for others, and Whitney Houston amongst others. I mean, oh, my God, the list goes on and on. And so we're going to talk to Jay, too, on Sunday the 24th at 9 p.m. Eastern. So, and next month, if you're listening and wondering when Michelle will be back, she'll be back on October 8th at 7 p.m. And, yeah, the special time, 7 p.m., not 8, not 9, 7 p.m. And then we've got a, oh, my goodness, we got a lot going on next month. I got to leave a few days open. There's some stuff going on that I have to, we're not going to do as many shows in October. We're going to try and do as many as we can, but we'll do our best. So anyway, check it out again. It is The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy, written by Mike Sidoni Lennox, co-authored by Chris May, and also with Richard Carpenter himself. And just great music. You can't get away from it. You'll never get away from it. And it's great music doesn't die. And it's a shame that we lost Karen, because, oh, my God, I'm sure we'd be seeing them performing out there together, the two of them, and just having a great time, and everybody just enjoying them for their music, their talent, and everything about them. And, you know, the 70s was a great time for music. The 60s, too. I mean, 50s, 60s, 70s, even the 80s. I mean, it was just that top 40 thing. No matter what was going on, like Chris mentioned, you know, A&M, rock was the thing, acid rock and all that was going on. But it didn't matter, because it was top 40. You had all styles of music playing on the radio at the same time. You'd have a heavy rock song, then you'd have the Carpenters, then you'd have disco, then you'd, it was just a great time for music. I mean, just great music. And I know that they didn't really care for their album covers, but at the time, they worked. That they were fine. They were fine. Nobody questioned them. I mean, I guess if you were the person on the album cover and you didn't like the picture, that's another story, right? But anyway, I mean, just great, great stuff. The Carpenters, they are legends in the music industry, and Richard alone is just an amazing arranger, composer, and just a fantastic musician. And of course, Karen with her wonderful, I didn't even want to try to come up with an adjective to describe her voice, because it just was so perfect, just perfect. And you didn't need anything behind it, no special effects. All they, like, back in the day, that's all he had. He had reverb, like Chris said, and overdubbing. That's it. You didn't have anything crazy. You didn't need it. You didn't need it. That was talent. You didn't need to pretend somebody sounded good by using auto-tune or whatever they're using now. They're using everything under the sun. Now, AI now. You got the artificial intelligence making voices sound good. Anyway, go check it out. Chris May, thank you so much. The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy. Check out the book and join us tomorrow night with Georgiana Nupi Rodriguez at 9 p.m. Take care, everybody. Have a happy rest of the week. Weekend is around the corner, and you guys have a good one. Thank you, Chris May. Take care. Bye-bye, everybody.
have only just begun to live. White lace and promises, a kiss for luck and we're on our way.
We've only begun.
I'm sorry. I know I said we were saying goodnight, but I got to hear this one. This is another one of my favorites. I meant to tell Rich. I love this one, too. After this one, I promise we're saying goodnight. So thank you again, Chris May. Check out the book, The Carpenters, The Musical Legacy. Get it anywhere online, Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your books. And thank you again, Chris. Have a wonderful night, everybody. Take care. We'll see you tomorrow with Georgiana Nupi Rodriguez on the 21st, 9 p.m. Eastern. Take care. Bye-bye.
No one in the world ever had a love as sweet as my love. For nowhere in the world could there be a boy as true as you love. All my love, I give gladly to you all your love. Closer.